Off the Ball Rugby.
The overwhelming kind of reaction is that he's fortunate to be selected there, that, you know, the likes of Tom Jordan, maybe Darcy Graham, that they're unlucky that they're not called up.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The News Round on Off the Ball.
With UPMC Orthopaedic Care. When things don't move, rotate or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action.
This is News Talk.
Good evening and welcome along to Monday night's Off the Ball. It's Owen here with you until 10 o'clock this evening. So we have an Irishman in the yellow jersey at the Tour de France for the first time since 1987. Ben Healy finishing third at today's stage through the Central Massif to lead the race at this stage. We're going to be speaking to Shane Stokes very shortly to talk us through a historic day for him, for Irish cycling, and to see what it means in terms of the future prospects throughout this race for Ben Healy and how long he's going to be able to hold on to this jersey for. Meanwhile, it is going to be Kerry versus Donegal in the All-Ireland Football Final. Donegal smashing Meath yesterday. Kerry more keeping Tyrone at arm's length on Saturday. Maybe an underwhelming weekend in terms of competitiveness, but it tees up a very appetising decider on Sunday week. So Colin Boyle, Darren O'Sullivan going to join us after 8 o'clock. And then in the 9 to 10 hour, Conor Nyland will reflect on finals weekend at Wimbledon. And Matt Williams will tell us whether or not we can expect a bit of an Aussie backlash from the Wallabies for this British and Irish Lions tour over the next few weeks. The first test coming up on Saturday at 11 a.m. Our number is 0879 180 180 if you want to get in touch about anything you want, anything over the sporting weekend that caught your eye, or Ben Healy today. We'd love to hear from you. Stephen Doyle will be bringing you our bumper news round in just a moment. Steve-O, how are you doing?
I'm all good, and I'm glad to hear you're in with the Yera, and you're not even out of your intro, and yeah, you're already in there with the Yera.
Kept throwing at arm's length.
Is that not a completely accurate representation of it?
On a scale of 1 to 10, 0 being no Yera at all, 10 being extremely Yera, tell us how Yera do you think Owen was there in the intro?
Let us know.
Well, I will tell you just from
Welcome back, Mick McCarthy.
Thank you.
Mick's been on holidays. He's straight back in. I was going to ask you how your holiday was, but
I really enjoyed it. I managed to watch two All Ireland semi finals. I watched a lot of Wimbledon. Just in case anyone was worried whether I was keeping up with the sport while I was away, I watched the France England game in the Euros. So, you know, that's like, you know, plenty of sport.
More than your working week, usually.
Absolutely, yeah. But I have some empirical evidence about whether you were yerring or not there. Because I had planned to talk about when you said that, I said, oh, I'm going to mention that yerring now when Owen says hello to me. And Steve-O came straight in with it.
No chance for us
to communicate on that. That was just that. This is exactly how we thought. So if we're 100% of the population thinks you were yerring there. If this sample size is big enough.
It is true. There was a woman
in the... I went to the match, as you know, on Saturday and saw you after. And there was a woman outside the pub that we had a drink in afterwards who was wearing the best T-shirt I've ever seen, which was a dark green T-shirt with yellow Yera. And that was the first thing I thought of when I heard Owen say that Kerry kept her own at arm's length.
Jim McGuinness could be the master of the era.
Oh, yeah.
Rite of passage is how he described Kerry's All-Ireland chances in the immediate aftermath of the game in the bowels of Croke Park yesterday. If you're describing your opposition on a rite of passage, then I think you're probably doing good work on that front. And also, Donegal are underdogs by 1 point. So I'm putting that empirical evidence out there. I'm not for 1 second saying that Kerry aren't favourites for this All-Ireland final.
I am as a dub. I'm just hypersensitive to Yera. So, you know,
yeah,
my apologies.
That's okay. I was going to start things off by saying like how yesterday could have been an amazing day at Croke Park if the scoreline was a lot closer, significantly closer. Like the atmosphere in there.
At 3:55, it felt like it was heading that way, didn't
unbelievable.
It?
Yeah. Unbelievable. It felt like Croke Park was ready for liftoff if Meath were able to kind of breathe down Donegal's neck for 40, 50, 60 minutes of the game. But that never happened as soon as the second half got up and running. And even from minute one, you're seeing the mind games between these teams. Donegal with the earliest peel-off in parade history. Are we saying that? Like I've never seen a team leave the parade underneath the Cusick stand before. Like the band was just left on their own.
It's very early. They didn't even make it as far as the hill.
No.
Yeah.
And then Meath followed suit afterwards. So is that mind games? I think
the teams should be told not to do that. I really do. I think it's for me the Gaelic games. My fan, especially when I was at the stadium as a fan at Croke Park. Nothing. It's such a unique thing, the march of the players behind the band. And this thing of peeing away early. Like, what's games? You get nothing from it. Like, you know, it's ridiculous. And just look, it's a tradition there that's been there for decades and decades.
As much as it used to.
Just tell the teams to stay in formation until whatever time it is. It just, yeah, I just think it's nonsense, really. And it's such a great thing.
Mead
and
all the fans deserve to see their team to the end. You win the mind game if you keep going all the way around.
Yeah.
And stand and stay standing there while the band finishes their little song, you know.
And that's why Donegal won by 20 points.
I think that's the first thing I thought of anyway. Yeah,
beforehand,
Mead broke and went to.
It's been a long time since we've seen this sort of beatdown in an All Ireland semi final. Probably Mayo against Cavan, or Mayo against Tip, I should say, or Dublin against Cavan in those 2020 All Ireland semi finals that they felt like unbelievably one sided. Games. I think maybe Mayo actually held the record and still do after yesterday. Like, no yarra about it. Just judging this thing in isolation, that was a statement from Donegal yesterday.
Yeah, no, 100%. The thing that, well, look, you know, Mead were really frustrating, especially in that kind of the last kind of 15, 20 minutes before half time, where they had so many opportunities to kick points. And it was almost the 2-pointer had become such an obsession. They kind of forgot that, well, there's, you know, maybe you should try going for a goal. And they were just so, they wasted so many opportunities in that run up till half time. They could have went in front. Now, I'm not saying that would have changed the second half. Maybe it would have, like, if they had been in front at half time, psychologically, it could have given them the boost to go on. But look, I think physically, I think the conditioning of Donegal as well is way ahead of those Mead players. And I think, do you know what, Robbie Brennan is a brilliant manager. I think he's breathed he's breathed fresh air into me, GAA, but also into Gaelic games across the country. He obviously has his great achievement with Kilmacud Crokes. And I think next year is going to be a big year for Mead. And look, Jim McGuinness even said in the post-match, he said there's a lot of young players in that Mead team are going to learn a lot from their experience yesterday. And I really hope they do, because we need, and especially as a Dublin fan, we need a strong Leinster. We want to see strong Leinster teams, and Mead beat Dublin this year, you know.
I think
so.
You also need the crowds from the counties that bring the kind of noise and colour that Mead brought to Croke Park yesterday. And it isn't every county in Ireland who can do that, and Mead are one of them. And it was the first time there was real, genuine excitement back in Mead football in a long time. So hopefully it does kick on, because that'll be very quickly forgotten on the back of how it ended this year if it doesn't kick on a little bit next year, you know. But my point, my takeaway from Donegal, much same as Steve-O's, is that kind of like physical endurance, and you know, you look at the way they, after playing 3 weeks in a row, how they finished against Monaghan, and then they got their week off. And I know you question whether that would even, like, you know, take away their momentum, but like, they looked rested and they looked ready. And I think it was the first time. It's hard to judge sometimes when the opposition isn't up to it or hasn't turned up, which I think is fair to say about Mead. But it was the first time they looked like the kind of Donegal we were talking about earlier in the championship. I remember talking to Colin Boyle. It was like, you know, very early in the championship, saying it's Donegal's to lose, you know. And that's gone away. And we haven't been thinking that way for a month or so now. Certainly since the Tyrone game.
And then a new chapter began in Croke Park.
It's starting to feel that way again, isn't it?
Definitely. The second half against Monaghan, I think, was, because it happens before Kerry do what they do to Armagh, it kind of got a little bit underrated in the aftermath.
They
of
also
it.
Hammered Louth, don't forget, as well. Now, I know that's, again, one of those things that we kind of lose. But if you look at their performances since that Tyrone game, their aggregate score must be absolutely massive.
And I'd like to see their aggregate score for and against in second halves of those three games. Because the Louth game was a contest at halftime.
Exactly.
The Monaghan game, they were losing at halftime. And the Meath game was a contest at halftime. They won all three games convincingly.
Yeah.
Which is a really impressive
note. Quick thing as well, the kickouts, like Meath did so well on the Donegal kickouts in that first half yesterday and won a lot of them. And I think that's something Kerry will be looking at. Like, obviously, they're going to be looking at the kickouts, you know. But the Armagh game, we saw what they did to Eton Rafferty in that Armagh game. So they're probably thinking, if we can do similar to Kerry or to Donegal in the final, like, Kerry could, you know, really, really put pressure on that Donegal kickout. And if it goes wrong to the extent it did against Meath, you know, that could be big trouble for Donegal.
There's been a bit of a reaction to the conversation around the parade. Owen's been in touch to say Limerick 96 All-Ireland Hurling broke away in Cusick Stand. Wexford walked all the way around.
And they won the All-Ireland. See, I was dead right.
Joe and Galway said a funny mind game would be to do another lap. Just keep walking as our honour being is happening.
Walk around the band. Like.
And then Robbie asks a ridiculous question. He asks, why is there a parade for a semi-final? I'll tell you why, Robbie, because parades are class. And it's one of the best. It was the best thing that happened in Croke Park yesterday.
I love the song parade. That they do for the parade. Like,
what is that song?
I have no earthly idea because I actually missed the start of the game. Because I had to run out the shop and I listened to the build up on the radio and I was actually thinking the exact same song, same thing. I was thinking, what is that song? It just makes me feel like amped up because the match is about to start.
Yeah.
That's the only thing I know it from.
It's an absolute banger from the Artane band, whatever that one is. Right, the news round is here with UPMC Orthopaedic Care. When things don't move, rotate or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action. And Steve-O, there really is only one place to start today.
Yes, well, sorry, just quickly give you the tunes. Quick Google there. The Bold Fenian Men first, then Down by the Glen Side, followed by God Save Ireland.
I'll
listen later. I'm not going to do a humming session here while we wait to talk about Ben Healy. But there's another song.
What's your favourite hum, Mick? Yeah. Ireland's Ben Healy will wear the yellow jersey on the start line the day after tomorrow. That's after winning today's stage, coming third in today's stage, but taking the yellow jersey. So ahead of the start of stage 10 today, Healy was 3:55 behind Tadej Pogacar. The Slovenian has won the tour, of course, three times, but finished a good bit behind the Irish rider today. Healy led the breakaway on today's stage for a long period but fell behind a few kilometres from the finish line. He finished in third place and was left to wait nervously on the line waiting for Pogacar to come home. He finished with Vangago and Martinez with a gap of 4:51. So Healy becomes the fourth Irish overall leader of the race, following on from Shea Elliott, Sean Kelly and Stephen Roach, who was the last Irishman to wear yellow in 1987. Healy has a 29-second lead on Pogacar in general classification, while he's also leading the standings for the best young rider and is second for the best climber standings. Here he is speaking to the official Tour de France post-race interviewer.
It's exactly that. It's a fairy tale, you know. If you told me this before the tour, I think I wouldn't have believed you, you know. So, say to win in yellow jersey, it's just incredible and beyond belief, really.
Where did you find the energy again today?
Yeah, I've got some good legs at the moment, you know. UAE surprisingly let a really big break go up the road, and we had four guys in there, and I've got to really say a massive thank you to Harry Sweeney and Alex Bodan today. You know, they were just incredible, and I'm just so glad I was able to finish it off in the end.
The last Irish rider to wear the and to win it actually was Stephen Roach. What does it mean for you to wear it?
Yeah, I mean, it's some pretty crazy footsteps to follow, isn't it? And I'm just super proud to represent Ireland and wear the yellow jersey for them, and hopefully I can do it some justice.
This morning I asked you if you were focused on GC. Now you have to be.
Yeah, I think it'd be rude not to be, you know. Got to respect the jersey, and I'm in quite a nice position now, I guess, to just try and hold on for as long as possible.
Yeah, a truly amazing day, and I'm delighted to say that Shane Stokes of Velo for Outside Magazine is with us on the line. Shane, a very good evening to you.
How are you? How's things?
Very well. So this is pretty extraordinary for people who weren't paying a whole pile of attention this afternoon to Stage 10. Talk to us about how it happened, how he went about this, and how he sensed the opportunity, as he said in that clip there, that UAE allowed to happen in this race.
Yeah, it was quite fascinating. A lot of things came together today. So you remember that he won Stage 6 on Thursday with a fantastic solo move. Today he was part of a very big breakaway that went clear. Yeah, they just gained more and more time. Ben Healy was, I think, originally thinking of going for the stage win, but then he was the best placed rider in that breakaway and realised, OK, the yellow jersey may be on here, and had to make a judgment call, because the way he rode in the end to ensure he got the time gap to take the yellow jersey, he was sacrificing his chances of winning the stage. So at some point his priorities shifted during the stage, and they continued putting in time. Ben Healy did the bulk of the work, particularly in the last 20 kilometres or so, and had enough at the end. What was interesting, though, beyond Ben Healy's performance, was that what was happening with Tadej Pogačar's UAE team. They lost João Almeida yesterday, a Portuguese rider who was fourth last year and one of the very strongest on the team, probably the strongest beyond other than Pogačar. And today, Pavel Sivakov, another rider with the team, was sick and ended up losing 35 minutes. So he was down two key men. And I think that was probably part of it as well, the way things played out, because last year Ben Healy in his first tour was on the attack several times in the mountains and was actually brought back each time by Pogacar's team, which was riding really hard to set Pogacar up for the big attacks that won him the tour. So there was two things came together today. I think it was Healy's strength and also then the UAE team having to play a little bit more defensively because of the injury-provoked withdrawal yesterday and then the illness today.
So a bit of a perfect storm, but are there greater vulnerabilities there when we look at UAE and Pogacar as these next few weeks develop?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And his main rival is Jonas Vingegaard. His Visma Lisa bike team today really took the fight to Pogacar and tried several times to break him and break his team. So they didn't succeed in gapping him in the end, but I think they probably made him quite worried. He still looks very strong, but I think his team is looking a little bit frail and definitely quite a bit different to last year. So while he's still quite a bit ahead of Vingegaard in the overall standings, I think with 2 weeks left in the tour, I think he's going to possibly have a sleepless night or two between now and Paris.
For Ben Healy, this is obviously an unbelievable moment, and I'm sure in his own head, if he had the decision between going for the stage win or getting into yellow, it was absolutely a no-brainer of a call. Just to be in this jersey, even for a couple of days, is massive for a young rider in, what is it, his second Tour de France ever?
That's right.
For his own visibility, for his own commercial capabilities, for the brand Ben Healy. Today is a massive moment for him.
Sure, absolutely. And it's 38 years, believe it or not, we all feel quite old realising that, but it's 38 years since Stephen Roach led the tour and indeed won the tour. So it's been a long, long wait. So it's quite a remarkable day. Ben Healy said that because he'd already won a stage, it made that judgment call a little bit easier because he had a stage win in the bag and he said, OK. So I think if he hadn't won the stage last week, he may have been quite torn between the two possibilities. But having the stage win already, it made him, I think, a bit more determined to go for yellow. So yeah, it's amazing for him. It's amazing for his team as well, because it would be seen as an underdog team. Traditionally, Dan Martin would have raced with them. There's quite a bit of an Irish contingent over the years. The Dan Martin, there's Ryan Mullen was previously with them. And now you've got Archie Ryan and Darren Rafferty, who are two really good riders. And then obviously, Ben himself. So yeah, there's quite a good Irish presence, notwithstanding it being an American team, and I think they'll be as delighted as Ben tonight to be leading the race, but also the fact that Ben is the guy leading the race.
There might have been a perfect storm with some of the other teams in today's stage, but also the tour so far has been a bit of a perfect storm in Ben Healy's favour, with the type of rider that he is. The short sharp climbs seems to be something that really suits him.
Yeah, and he's not bad on the long climbs either, so I wouldn't rule him out in terms of the, because we still have yet to hit the really long ascents, which the tour is known for, and that's going to come after tomorrow's rest day. It's going to become more and more a pattern in the race. But Ben, last year, it's quite interesting. So last year he went in the attack multiple times. He was incredibly strong and absolutely strong enough to win a stage, but he just was each time brought back by the UAE team. So that was a little bit in his favour because they're a bit under strength this year. And what's also interesting is that he is known as a diesel engine. So he's very good at going all day, but doesn't have much of an acceleration is how it's certainly viewed in cycling anyway. And that's the term for somebody who's not very explosive, but really good at continuous effort. And it made him quite predictable, because he's won a lot of big races, but he's also lost a lot of big races because riders mark him and they know that if Ben is going to win, he's got to try and drop everybody else because his sprint isn't fantastic. And he tended to attack, up until this year, really, he tended to attack from the front and try and ride people off his wheel. So he was able to do that on the days. He was incredibly strong. He won a Giro d'Italia stage that way and won other races that way. But he went off and he did a lot of homework, if you like, over the winter. So firstly, he tried to work on his explosivity to make him a bit more punchy and to be able to get gaps a little bit more easily. But secondly, and you saw that on stage six when he won last week, he went and studied a lot of race footage to try and see when to attack, how to attack, how to catch people out, and so not to be as predictable as before. What was very interesting about last week's win was he attacked hard up the left-hand side of a group, and there was hardly a gap there between him and the side of the road. It was actually very, very evocative of Stephen Roach, the way he won the World Championships in 1987 in Austria was almost a carbon copy, although Roach was much closer to the finish. But it was the same thing, going from behind and going through this tiny gap, and in each case the riders moved over to the right and gave him the gap. So I plan on talking to Ben tomorrow during the rest day, and I will ask him if he has seen, because Ben is just 24, so obviously Roach predates him quite a lot. But you know, has he seen that footage, and indeed what footage he studied so well to refine his tactics? But you're seeing the fruits of that now paying off, how he's changed as a rider and grown as a rider.
Definitely. It seems like it's been a massive year for him. Now, it's not as if this is the first time Ben Healy has broken onto the consciousness of, you know, even a casual cycling fan. Like, a stage win at the Giro 2 years ago was definitely that moment, I guess. From your own perspective, Shane, as somebody who follows it intimately, was Ben Healy one of the guys who was always going to break through as the best Irish rider of his generation? Or, I know he's only 24, was he relatively a late bloomer where what he's doing this year is above expectations?
Yeah, I think it's a continuous progression, actually. And if anything, last year, you know, he had a really good classic season, and obviously the Giro d'Italia stage win 2 years ago. Last year was, until he got to the Tour de France, where he was riding really strongly, but he was a little bit understated in the classics where he'd done so well in the years before. But he has made it really quite a linear progression. At 18 years of age, he was the youngest ever stage winner in the Tour de l'Avenir, which is the under 23 version of the Tour de France, and has been won by, you know, huge names in the past. So he showed his class by taking a win at 18, which was pretty much unheard of in that race. So it's been just a gradual evolution, and I think he would have won a lot more had he worked on the tactics a little bit sooner and that explosivity which I mentioned. So yeah, it's a very good progression. He's really good. It's a pity Eddie Dunbar crashed out of the race, because Eddie Dunbar was also in the break with Ben on Thursday, and Eddie Dunbar was fourth when, in what is his first tour, was fourth behind Ben when Ben won the stage. And I really believe that Eddie probably would have been up in a stage like today as well. But unfortunately, he crashed and withdrew yesterday because of injuries. So he's another guy, if you talk about the best of generation. I think Eddie is really, really good as well. And I think we're quite lucky to have those two now. And then there's some really good riders coming through as well. So it's really quite an encouraging time. And the beauty of success is it kind of empowers other riders that will know Ben to believe that they too can achieve the same thing.
Given it's so long ago since there's been an Irishman in yellow, it is going to be a brand new sports viewing experience for Irish people in 2 days' time. You know, this strange emotive thing of, can he hold on to yellow? I know it's not an exact science. You don't know how teams are going to approach the next couple of stages, and the Pyrenees are coming down the tracks very shortly. But how long do you think we will have this experience for? Will we get a couple of days out of it?
Yeah, I'm going to look at the profile of the stages. So the stage on Wednesday is Toulouse, and it's a lot of short, sharp, punchy climbs, and then a flat run into the line. So that's pretty good for Ben. Yeah, the following day is Hautacam, which is one of the big summit finishes, and I think, I still believe that if it's a straight out fight, and most people would accept this, that Pogačar and Vingegaard are a level above Ben Healy. Ben Healy is young, he's evolving. These guys have both won the Tour in the past. So I think at a climb like Hautacam, they will gain time on him. I think Pogačar, you know, given that his team is under strength, I think he'd be quite happy if Ben holds yellow after Wednesday's stage and holds it into the Hautacam stage. So yeah, I think it's quite possible that he'll defend yellow. I think bigger picture, do I see him beating Pogačar and Vingegaard overall, you know, into Paris? I don't see that, and not this year. I think it's going to take him a couple of years to keep growing in that role, because he hasn't ever really pursued that role, certainly in a race like the Tour. It's always been about stages. But top 10 overall, if he puts his mind to it, absolutely, and quite a bit better than top 10 is possible, I think.
And then lastly, it sounds like you're making this a two-horse race between Pogačar and Vingegaard. Are you riding Evenepoel out of it?
Yeah, I think so at this point in time anyway, you know, barring some major turnaround in form, which obviously the Tour, anything can happen and things can progress. And, you know, it just takes one crash to put, touch wood, it won't happen, but to put one of the two other guys out of the race or somebody getting COVID, which has happened in the past, etc. You know, that. So, yeah, but I think going by certainly their experience the results in the past, but also how they've been riding this year. It is definitely Pogacar and Vingegaard are the two clear guys, with Evenepoel and a couple of others maybe as fighting for the third step of the podium.
Shane, appreciate you filling us in on the magnitude of today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah.
Cheers. That's Shane Stokes writing for Velo for Outside Magazine. What we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break at the rest of Steve O's news round on the other side of ads. But before that, it's time for the Cash Machine.
On this morning's Off the Ball Breakfast,
we had this.
The way I felt driving home last night was Donegal are primed, right? I'm not sure there's a faster fella left in Donegal. I'm not sure there's a stronger lad left in Donegal. I'm not sure there's a footballer left in Donegal that isn't involved in Jim McGuinness's unit right now. Like, the depth they have is off the charts.
And we also had this.
An interesting side note to this story is maybe the involvement of Katie Taylor's dad, Pete Taylor, in this one, as far as I'm aware, not like an integral part of the fight camp, right? You know, so he's not there at ringside. He's not in America for the training camps. But a couple of weeks ago, you know, when the fight's being signed and stuff, Taylor's back in Europe and she goes to train with her dad, I think, over in the Netherlands. And from what I gather, like, the two of them are, you know, completely reconciled now after, you know, some differences a few years back.
You can catch everything from this morning's Off the Ball Breakfast right here on the Goal Out app and every weekday morning from 7:30.
Welcome back to Monday Night's Off the Ball. It's Owen here in studio alongside Mick and Steve-O. Steve-O's bumper news round continues with the golf.
Yes. And the three-time major champion, Padraig Harrington. Well, they say, is it an honour to hit the opening shot at the Open? I'm not so sure when you look at the time he's going to be up on Thursday morning. Padraig Harrington, of course, three-time major champion, is going to hit the Open tee shot of the Open, which begins on Thursday. He was the last player to win successive editions of this particular major, lifting the claret jug in 2007 and 2008. Harrington will tee off at 6:55 on Thursday morning, so I gather he'll have to be up around maybe 4:30 or 5:00. Not a bother to Padraig Harrington, though, I'm sure. Now, Rory McIlroy obviously held his press conference today. Shane Lowry as well. Let's hear from McIlroy first. He was basically just being asked about his thoughts on the week coming up.
I mean, it's pretty obvious. The two big things left this year is this tournament and the Ryder Cup. You know, those are, you know, the two massive things that are left on the golfing calendar. And yeah, they're the, you know, I think what I found as well is, you know, after 2 weeks off and getting that excitement and that enthusiasm back, it's like, you know, I sort of approached last week and this week as like a 14-day chunk of, you know, getting some really good work in, especially last week. But then, you know, doing your prep away from tournament golf, but then, okay, this is your time to lock in for 2 weeks and do everything that you need to do. And then reset again, and then, you know, try and build myself back up for the Ryder Cup. And I know I've got some events between here and the Ryder Cup, but, you know, obviously wanting to have my very best stuff when we go to New York. So, you know, that's, I think, after the Masters, you know, obviously I had the PGA and the US Open up there in terms of goals. I felt like the PGA was just maybe a bit soon, and I didn't know what was, you know, I didn't know how I felt. And then US Open was okay. It was just a, you know, I started slow and then sort of took me a while to get into the tournament a little bit, but finished with a decent last day. But as I said, it's been nice to get back over this side of the pond, change of scenery, reset a little bit. You know, I'm really excited for, obviously, this week, but, you know, I'm excited for the rest of the year with the Ryder Cup, India, Australia, and everything else that's to follow.
So, Shane Lowry returning to the venue of his sole major success. The Offaly man won the claret jug at Portrush in 2019. I'm not sure if you've seen the mural. There's a big mural for Shane Lowry up in Portrush as well. Looks really good. He himself felt a little embarrassed, he was saying, when he saw that. But look, he's played some good golf this year, but has had some poor finishes over the weekends. And Lowry got some pretty direct questioning from an American journalist at his press conference today.
There does seem to be this sort of like narrative out there that you're this big drinker and big partier. Yeah. Are you kind of over it, or?
Look, I let people believe what they want to believe, and I just kind of do my own thing. And the people close to me know what I'm like, and Don't get me wrong, I do enjoy it from time to time, but I know when I need to put my head down and work, I know when I need to do that. You can't be, you know, at the top level of any sport, you know, if you're not applying yourself well, and I feel like I do it.
You know, I have to question an Irishman 101. Are you a big drinker?
I
know,
that was like the third question, I think, at the press conference. It was like, I'd say all the other journalists were like, oh, no, not now.
I know.
Wait.
Like, at the venue of his greatest ever achievement and where he's like full on center of attention, it's like, oh, you like a drink, Shane, do you?
Unbelievable.
You know, oh, God.
Yeah. I think, though, the way he finished it was actually a quite good answer. He was like, look, you can't be at the top level of any sports, you know, if you don't put your head down. And he certainly does that.
The thing I took from the McElroy clip more than anything else, other than, like, you know, a man who's trying to just keep talking until his brain stops in the hope that something comes out that makes sense, is that I'm glad that he is moving back to this side of the Atlantic, because he spent too much time in America putting the emphasis on the word rider rather than the word cup. Big no-no if you're from this one. The Ryder Cup.
Okay, where
as opposed
we say
to
Ryder
the
Cup.
Ryder Cup, yeah.
Oh, interesting.
And we do for loads of different things as well. It's always spot an American by the emphasis on the first word of a double barrel.
Shane Lowry mural is class.
Yeah, one of the best murals I've seen up in the north of Ireland, I have to say. It's, the only thing, though, his hair is very red. No offence now, Owen, but his hair is quite red in the mural. Yeah. It's not. He's not red-headed.
No, he's not, but, you know.
No, I'd say that's pretty good, yeah.
It's pretty, I think a bit of ginger does nobody any harm.
No, not at all. Beautiful. I've got ginger in my beard.
Yeah, very
quite
good.
Quite proud of it.
Right, so that is the Open this week. We're going to be speaking to Nathan throughout the next couple of days. Remember to listen to Golf Weekly as well for their bumper build-ups to the Open this weekend. We are turning our attention now to the rugby, Steve-O.
Yeah, there's the Lions camp playing down concerns about Mac Hansen's fitness ahead of Saturday's first test against Australia. The Connacht winger picked up an arm injury in the weekend victory over a New Zealand and Australian Invitational 15. Hansen took a limited part in training in Brisbane today with Tom Clarkson and Jamie Osborne also linking up with their new squad mates.
Watched some rugby while I was away as well, actually. Sorry, I forgot about that. Watched it at the pool.
What are you thinking?
The Lions?
Yeah. The midweek game,
The Brumbies game last week,
yeah.
That's so you're obviously on board. That seems to have been the big question over the last couple of weeks. Are people on board the Lions bandwagon yet? And the reason why the question has been asked is because the answer is invariably no.
Yeah, I'm as Irish and British as the next man. You know, when it comes to the Lions. No, it's funny, we were talking about it earlier, and like I bring my son to his little football, like his 3-year-old football thing, and it's at 11 o'clock on Saturday mornings, and it's like I'm like, oh God, it's like, you know, that's the first half of all three games gone, but like I'm also not doing it. Because this is such a big event, you know, and the worst thing you can do for not being into the Lions is not watching it, though, because then all the noise around it just becomes too much. And, you know, if you will get into it if you watch
you
these games. Like, Miles Harrison will bring me into any rugby game. You know what I mean? He's a fantastic commentator. There is a genuine buzz about him. The stadiums are going to be full. Like, the test matches and everything around it is great. But, yeah, sometimes it can be a bit of a chore getting there.
Yeah, we're going at it from the Australian angle. This evening, Matt Williams is going to join us after 9 o'clock. There's just only so many times you can have the conversation around
who's starting in the centre.
I will be asking Matt Williams that later on. I mean, but it's
Hugh Pilato.
I hadn't realised that was actually what they're referring to. Them
no,
as.
Yeah, I've seen that a few times.
Very,
yeah.
Very smart.
What effect do you think Owen Farrell will have on the camp?
I should ask him that actually. But I think once the first test begins, then I think everybody will sort of be into this in a real non-metaphorical
what if it's
80-0? It won't be 80-0.
No, it won't.
Nah.
If it's 80-0, then the entire series is a bit screwed.
We're in trouble then.
There'll
be
talk about should the Lions ever go back to Australia again, and certainly in 12 years' time. Returning our attention to football, Steve, we have a player charged with a breach of betting rules in the UK.
Yeah, and it's got an Irish link to this story. Notts County defender Lewis McCarry has been charged for breaching betting rules by the English FA. The 23-year-old is alleged to have placed over 350 bets between February 2020 and December 2022. Now, McCarry was on the books at Stoke City when he's alleged to have placed the bets and was on loan at Dundalk during that time. He was on loan there from February till November of 2022. He has been given until July 18th to respond to those charges.
Now, there is a former player taking a case against Manchester United.
Yeah, United are being sued by their former player, Axel Tuanzebe, for clinical negligence. The 27-year-old, who left Old Trafford 2 years ago, has lodged a legal claim at the High Court related to medical advice he was given. Tuanzebe has signed for Burnley earlier this summer.
Cove Ramblers?
Yeah, the new owners of the Cork club own are promising to usher in a new era at Coleman Park. The Florida-based Digital Athlete Ventures Group have completed an acquisition of 90% of the shares in the First Division club, and they've pledged to foster long-term sustainability and growth.
I should say, by the way, if you want to get in touch this evening, you can also get us in the live chat on our YouTube stream. PG has been in touch there to say Healy's teammates rode themselves into the ground to get the gap. Brilliant team effort from them, which certainly seemed to be the case this afternoon. Turning our attention back to Gaelic games now, Steve-O, Jim McGuinness speaking in the aftermath.
Yeah, the Donegal manager says sticking to their values has helped them return to the All-Ireland football final for the first time since 2014. Oisín Gallan, Kieran Moore and Conor O'Donnell all found the net as the Ulster champions eased past Meath by 20 points in yesterday's semi-final at Croke Park. McGuinness's team will face Kerry in the decider, with the Kingdom also impressive in seeing off Tyrone by 6 points on Saturday. Here's our own Tommy Rooney speaking to McGuinness after they defeated Meath.
You got three brilliant goals. The finishes by Oisín Gallan and Conor O'Donnell were fantastic, but the Kieran Moore goal, it comes from a turnover and the hard running out of defence from your Donegal team. As coach, that must have been so satisfying to see that one come off.
Oh, listen, it's great. It's great. You know, there's a good bit of commentary, I suppose, about how we play sometimes. And maybe it is a wee bit different than other teams, but you know, without covering the same ground all the time, you know, that's who we are. Like at this stage of the game, you know, we know what we want to do, and it's been in our blood for a long, long time, and we just try to tap into that. And I think it was Finbar that turned that one over, a brilliant turnover, and we got all the way up the pitch and made it count. You know, which is great. It's encouraging. You know, we're creating even the first half. We created some goal scoring opportunities, and we kind of felt that if we could keep at it and keep tussling ourselves, we could get into more goal scoring opportunity moments, and that's the way it panned out. So yeah, that's positive. Obviously, you know, trying to keep that going is the big one now.
Owen, I know you not writing Meath off, but you've been thinking about Donegal since the full time whistle on Saturday evening, let's just say, as they were favourites on Sunday. Then they went out and did what they did. What's your worry level? How do they match up to Kerry?
I think they match up very well. Somebody said to me yesterday that Brendan McCall is going to destroy David Clifford in the final.
Right, okay. That's about the sixth or seventh person I've heard is going to destroy David Clifford.
Yeah, matching up, I'd say they match up very well. Like, relative to what Clifford has been up against this year, I would suggest that McCall is going to be the man who's got the best chance of curbing Clifford. Stopping him is an entirely different thing, but limiting him to 5-6 points, which tends to be a good day out against him, particularly in the new rules. 6 points is probably a good outing. I think maybe he has the potential to do that, but Donegal seem to have the system with which to do it. Their zonal defence, with the exception of McCall, who tends to mark the danger man, is really interesting. Their press is exceptional, and look, Tyrone managed to get Kerry under a lot of pressure in that first half, and Kerry just managed to unpick the Tyrone press about a third of the way through the game, which I guess was an impressive reaction, but I think Donegal will be better in that regard as well. And also, was Tyrone's shooting late in the game not appalling on Saturday evening?
Like, while it was still a game.
Yeah. While it was still a game, I think that could have been a real nerve check for Kerry late into the game last Saturday.
I did think that Kerry had something to do with that, though. I think as it went on, I think the heads went, and I think that Niall Morgan not taking that free, I think, kind of summed that up, really, that there was something kind of like that, you know, the game was out of sight, maybe, even though I don't think it was at that stage. That would have brought it back to 4 points if he kicked that two-pointer. But I think up until that point, it was a lot of forced bad shots, I would say, by good defending. I was actually very impressed with how Kerry did adapted over the course of the game.
Are we going to see any pre-final espionage going on?
Well, they have chopped down all the trees outside Fitzgerald Stadium. Literally, they did react to the last time.
Technology
has actually happened.
Yeah,
because of that.
That tree has been cut down.
No way.
Yeah.
That is mad, isn't it?
Unbelievable.
You're no longer able to peer over the wall.
That tree. like the Kerry County Board cut down the tree?
I'm sure it is. Or maybe Eamon Fitzmaurice himself.
Sorry, not the County Board. The Kerry County Council, I meant to say.
But presumably.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, was it like just a rogue member of the backroom staff or something, but certainly.
That's what I'm saying. That's vandalism if just like someone in Kerry, someone from Kerry football did it.
Yeah, one spy too many. Is what happened there. So never again is how they viewed that situation. Of course,
there has been though, like serious developments in technology in those last 11 years, and there are ways and means of flying a camera over a pitch these days.
Like a drone? Is that what you're describing? A drone?
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know,
put a tricolor. Get the one that they used at the. In the Shankill Road there in the weekend.
I actually, I saw there was a drone display before Oasis at Heaton Park there on Friday night. Was it Friday night? And it did the Oasis logo in lights, and somebody had tweeted the picture saying the bat signal for divorced dads. Anyway.
The thing is, Jim McGuinness got caught from a spy since that All-Ireland final. Do you remember when he was involved with the Galway footballers during COVID?
Oh, yeah.
And somebody, it was in Salt Hill, and somebody in their back garden had caught Jim McGuinness doing like a hand-passing drill to the Galway footballers, and that spread like wildfire that he was going to be essentially involved with poor Joyce around that stage. So both managers have been stung in the past. It's
quite a famous final like that in 2014. Like it was the, what do you think of that, Joe Brawley, you know, Donaghy, there was the rumours about Gooch coming back, do you remember? Because he was on the bench, togged out, of course, nowhere near fit to play.
No.
Like, he'd done his cruise a few months before. I remember being really like at the match thinking like this is a good contest, like a real close game and, you know, not overly worried. And then like RT ripped the game to shreds, and by the time you talk to everybody the next day, it was the worst All-Ireland final of all time. You know, because the narrative is fed by what you hear first when you watch the game, you know, so... Yeah, I think we'll do a bit of reminiscing over the next couple of weeks.
Nick Kerr has been in touch on YouTube to say, Kerry into the final and still not been tested. Ulster football is a myth. Cork and Meath gave them the only tough games this year. But then I suppose Meath and Donegal yesterday, maybe. Does that put Ulster football back in the pedestal?
I'd say Armagh were 6 points up against them there at one point in the second half. And at some stage you have to say that Kerry are doing something to... You know, the All-Ireland champions, they scored 14 points in a row. I don't understand why they weren't tested. Mm-hmm. Surely that was a test.
I would think so. Will we move on to the tennis yesterday?
Yeah, absolutely. So, if I can find my script here. Yes, Yannick Sinner says, it feels amazing to be the new Wimbledon champion. He defeated the two-time defending champion Carlos Alcaraz in yesterday's final on centre court. The world number one recovered from a set down to beat the Spaniard in four sets. A victory gives him a first title at the All England Club and a fourth Grand Slam crown.
It was very kind of Donegal to destroy Meath in such a way to allow people to go over to the tennis nice and early.
Yeah. It
big time.
It stopped the need for the double screening because, let's face it, the focus had been on the tennis for quite a while at that point. But look, it feels... I think we can talk about the two winners of Wimbledon and everything, you know, that goes with that, but... If you can separate from that, and I don't know if you can, like the final of the French followed by this, it feels like it's made tennis a bit big time again. For the first time in quite a while, I would say, you know, that it does feel like this rivalry between these two players and their domination over the game. And to be honest, when you're watching it, and I probably watch more tennis over the last couple of months than I have in years, the quality of both of them. Now, Alcaraz... I think wilted a little bit yesterday, and I just don't think he had any answers for Sinner. So you're specifically talking about Sinner now. And then I just find I can't enjoy it. You know, just because there's that question there, and that it's two things. There's the question there because of the doping ban and whether you take his explanation or not. And we've talked to people who would be very, very down on the ban being what it was, who would also say we really genuinely don't know if he was innocent or not, like, because it fit all the hallmarks, I suppose, of a genuine accidental breach, you know. But obviously the way it was handled is gross. So you have that, so you have the unknowing plus the kind of like being annoyed at the way tennis is operating that he was let off with it, you know. So I suppose it's almost ruining something that I think could be bringing tennis back to the forefront again.
And is that why people want to ignore the questions around Yannick Sinner?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Because it's kind of like a perfect rivalry.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's ultimately, and also I think that less people care about this stuff than we ever give credit for, you know.
And maybe people care
in
less.
In terms of fans and things like that, in terms of like people go, and people don't even know the details a lot of the time. They just want to see, yeah, he's brilliant at tennis. Yeah. Like, and he genuinely is, right? I don't care what he's taking. He is, the shots he pulls out are phenomenal. His accuracy is unbelievable. He's got such an all-round game, like, you know. Mm. And he's also just won the US Open, the Australian Open. Was match point up in a French Open final. He should have won, and then he won Wimbledon. Now, he's had a nice three-month break in there, so he's fresh as a daisy as well, whereas Alcaraz probably didn't have much left, you know, but his dominance is unreal.
And the level at which they're playing at is extraordinary, especially late into the matches, which is why I really do care about what these people are taking.
Yeah, I do. I absolutely do.
If there are any, even boundaries being pushed, I kind of want to know what the information is that's out there. Even if there are accidental breaches, like, I really do believe that they should be punished in accordance with how every other tennis player in the world would be treated, as opposed to this preferential treatment that Sinner gets because he's a generational talent.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, if there's a question about this guy's endurance
in
any way, that is so unbelievably important for the audience, for everybody to know that.
It should be the opposite. You should be going harder on these people because they're the linchpin of which your sport is judged.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And if you want a clean sport, it's like, I'm sorry, it is bad luck on you if it is bad luck, but, you know, you serve your punishment.
Yeah,
and proper one.
I think a lot of this, you need to kind of turn your attention to the ITIA, the International Tennis Integrity Agency. Seems to be a lot of people would question, you know, the procedures around what happened to Yannick Sinner, not just Yannick Sinner, but the women's champion as well.
Świątek, yeah.
Iga Świątek, who won in straight sets, 6-love, 6-love. And, like, she was, if you go back on that case, she's a six-time Grand Slam winner. And she tested positive for heart medication, TMZ, out of competition, August 2024. And she got a one-month suspension. Now, there was a Russian figure skater, Kamila Valieva, got a four-year ban for testing positive for TMZ before the 2022 Winter Olympics. So a one-month ban for Świątek. And then, of course, Sinner. It was a totally different substance. It was a banned anabolic steroid, Clostebol, used to build muscle mass. But of course, he had that story about his physio, and the physio had a cut in his,
cut in his finger.
Sinner that had
the cut in the finger.
Exactly. Yeah. So, you know, whatever about these stories, this dark cloud hangs over the two of them. And I was kind of more annoyed at BBC yesterday because it was almost like this kind of phoenix from the flames narrative that they set after the victory. It was like, you know, this fella, and I'm paraphrasing here, was like, he battled back from his
adversity.
The word they used was resilience. He showed great resilience to battle back from his off the court troubles. You're kind of going, well,
and not
he
even
didn't.
Explaining what they are.
Yeah, you know, they never mentioned
treating it as a positive,
doping once, which is just completely terrible from the BBC, you know. So, I think it's a dark cloud hangs over the two champions, to be honest, for me. And I don't think that's going to be going away anytime soon for
a lot
of people.
It's a mad story, the whole thing, because don't forget as well, it was in, was it even quarterfinal? I think it was the fourth round where he was two sets to love down.
Yeah.
And his opponent retired through injury. And I was watching that live, and you could see the pec muscle, and you could see it was a devastating thing. And, you know, even that, it's the complications of it all. You know, you don't always have to hate the sinner. Take the sin, I didn't even actually mean that. I swear to God, I didn't even mean that.
But that's our peak of the show.
Sinner, it would have been, if I actually meant it as a joke, it would have been quite funny, but it was a genuine mistake. But Sinner, acted brilliantly during all that. You know what I mean? And he comes across very well, I have to say. Now, that, you know, you don't take much from that. Mm. But again, I just think it is complicated because there is a huge part of us all that just wants to enjoy, you know, almost a rebirth. I'm looking forward to the US Open in some ways now and seeing them go at it again.
And it's
he's got ankles like rubber, by the way, as well. Did you see some of the sliding across the course? His ankles are they're like double jointed or something. It's incredible.
There's definitely a case to be made that Sinner's actually going to come out on top in this rivalry, but I think it'll be, if you want to do it, maybe overreact a little bit to yesterday. It's like these guys are booking a break, 20 slams. So that's the beginning of a rivalry. I think did we witness the end of a great rivalry on Friday night at the Garden between Katie Taylor?
To think so now. I don't think there can be possibly a number four. I think you're milking it then if that's the case. But look, I think it's funny, Eddie Hearn is you know, he's paid to sum it up a little bit, and he's paid to hype things, and, you know, that's his entire outlook, so you always don't take it seriously. But I think, you know, the way he spoke after the fight, when he said about, he kind of really put Katie Taylor into perspective of, like, you know, this was a sold out crowd in Madison Square Garden on an all female card, and they're kind of like, you know, these girls on the undercard who are getting paid biggest ever paydays of their life, and it's all because of her. And I think Serrano even kind of really conceded that in the aftermath and so on. And it's like, it's hard to put into words. It's hard to keep talking about it. And we're going to talk to Ross tomorrow night, Katie's coach. I'm looking forward to that. But her achievements are just unbelievable. Like, you know, they're just unparalleled. And every time you think maybe it's a step too far, it isn't. You know, she's never once let us down. She did that one fight against Chantel Cameron that, you know, I think is closer, but, like, I mean, she's won close fights too, so it's not to say she didn't lose or anything like that. And then came back and won the next day. And then every other time she has answered.
Yeah.
It's like what an incredible sporting career. Like,
it's,
and it might be over and it might not be, but even if it's not, we should enjoy it in the moment, you know?
Yeah, no, definitely. And also it's interesting because Amanda Serrano seemed to approach this in a little bit of a different way. Like, you could even get a bit of a hint from her coach telling her, I think was it after maybe round 5, round 6, don't get into a war.
Yeah.
The first two fights were absolute wars, so that was clearly part of their mantra. Let's change this up a little bit. Let's make this maybe a little bit boring. And Katie managed to come out on top from that
as
well.
I think that was a mistake by them as well, because I think you lure into a war, it becomes a punching game. I think it suits Serrano better, and it clogs the judges a little bit. There was no clogging the judges like this. You know, it's Katie did exactly what her coaches always wanted her to do, and she's never allowed it to happen. And easy night.
Yeah, for sure. And
big shout out to Andy Lee as well, because he had a great win with Hamza Shiraz over the weekend, 5th round knockout, and he's got Paddy Donovan's world title fight coming up soon. So
for sure,
best of luck to him.
Stephen Doyle, thank you for Monday's bumper news round. Mick will be chatting to you a little bit later on.
Thanks.
The news round on Off the Ball
with UPMC Orthopaedic Care. When things don't move, rotate, or bend like they used to, choose us to help you get back in action.
This is News Talk.
Off the Ball, rugby.
The overwhelming kind of reaction is that he's fortunate to be selected there, that, you know, the likes of Tom Jordan, maybe Darcy Graham, that they're unlucky that they're not called up.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.